You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is my producer and engineer. Yes, he can do everything. Dennis Wu, and he has also been my co-host for several other shows. And he's here joining me with one of our students, Lawrence Brown. You may be familiar with him if you've heard him on the jazz show. So we want to take the time to thank Lawrence because he hung around. It's very hot outside, and he waited till our class was over to wait for us. So thank you very much, Lawrence,
for being with us. That's no problem at all.
And let's start, first of all, people are wondering, why are you having Lawrence on your show? What's so special about Lawrence? Well, everyone is special. Everyone has something special about them. And Lawrence, I told you that I was not a politically correct guy, and the fact that I was going to say that you were born blind, not visually impaired. You were born blind. Basically, you can't see.
Basically, I was born with light perception. I could see very basic colors, very basic, and that was just about it. I mean, that was about as far as it went. And I was born with something called optic nerve hypoplasia, and I was diagnosed at 3 or 4 months.
Now, most children, the babies, when they're about that age, they're still crawling around and, you know, doing things. Were you bumping into things or doing things that alerted your mother and your father to take you to the doctor?
It wasn't – I mean, I was still so young that I didn't really – I wasn't crawling super extensively around the house to where I could – you know, where I was unsupervised for long periods of time. What did happen, though, was my mom, you know, kind of started to notice – that I wouldn't focus on her, that I wouldn't look at her, you know. And babies are obviously very inquisitive, and once they are get full control of their sight, they want to see everything. And that wasn't the case with me. And so it became a game, like, can Lawrence focus on this spoon? You know, can he focus on this? Can he focus on me moving that? And it became – it got to the point where it was like, well, there's something obviously wrong here. And so they took me to the doctor. They took me to Dr. Doka here in El Paso, and –
Great doctor, by the way.
Yeah. He's pretty good. Him and
so Vasquez, what happened, Lawrence, when Dr. Doka told your parents the diagnosis?
Not much happened. I mean, optic nerve hypoplasia is not a condition of the eye. It is a condition of the optic nerve in the brain. And I can consider myself very blessed because this condition generally comes with dwarfism. It comes with growth problems, sometimes hormonal problems, autism, and I have none of those things. So I'm really very, very blessed. But basically, Dr. Doka said, you know, you don't have too much of a choice here. Here is the number for Region 19, and best of luck to you. You know, they went to Albuquerque for a second opinion. Same thing. You know, that's there is nothing – there is no treatment here in the United States that can make this better, and any treatment that there is in the world is still experimental as it is.
And did you go to a regular school, or when you went to Region 19, did they put you in a special school?
Oh, no. My mom was a really firm believer in mainstreaming me, what we call mainstreaming, you know, in ordinary classes with ordinary kids. I really thank her for that. You know, she was very, very, very good about making sure that I had all the materials that I needed to be on a level playing field with sighted students. I went to school with sighted students. However, during the summer, she was also very good about making sure that I went to summer camps for the visually impaired. I went to several conventions around Texas, and you know, for the visually impaired, I went to the School for the Blind in Austin for a math program. When I was struggling with math in middle school, high school, I guess I should say, I had a good balance. I know there's a lot of visually impaired or blind students that go to schools for the blind. I have a friend who went to the one in Alamogordo in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. I have several friends who went to some in Austin. However, I think it's important to mainstream your child because it socializes them to sighted people, I'm going to be very honest here. I find that visually impaired people that spend too much time in those schools for the blind come out and they're not socially equipped to deal with a sighted world. However, I also think it's important that you also socialize your visually impaired or blind child with other blind people, because that's a whole other culture in itself, and you need to know about the technology that's available to you, you know, and you need to be in a setting where everybody reads Braille. Everybody bumps into each other at those camps. You know, it's not like there's a magic thing and nobody, you know, it's that in itself is also interesting.
Do you find that sighted people will oftentimes patronize?
Oh, yeah. All the time. You run into it on a daily basis. It's, you know, I had an experience here on campus where I had my advisor tell me, music based on your disability, music is not the right career for you. And so now she's gone and given me the strength to go ahead and push so hard. And, you know, she'll be the first to receive a copy of my degree, my bachelor's and my master's.
Now, Lawrence, people may remember that a few years ago, there was a story in the newspaper about you. You had gone to China for some, I guess, experimental medication or medicine, if you want to call it that.
Sure.
Or was it experimental?
It was extremely experimental. I got 9 stem cell injections, and they treat a variety of different brain-related diseases over there in China and at a couple of different hospitals around the region. They treat things like multiple sclerosis. They treat Lou Gehrig's disease. They treat other optic nerve conditions. And, you know, you go and you get the injections and you hope for the best. There is a girl that I saw her story and she is now driving. However, she started off with more vision than I had. She could read large print with one eye. So that's you know, substantially more than I have ever had or you know, had in the beginning. I did get some improvements. I can choose my own clothes, which is a big help for me. I have a little bit of depth perception, you know, to things. I can see around corners. I describe it to people as I understand what three-dimensional means on in a visual way. However, shapes are still quite faint and things like that. So, you know, it was experimental. I got back and, you know, people asked me, are you going to go again? Are you going to want to go again? Are you going to, you know, and I actually came to the point where I decided I wasn't going to go again. Not now, at least, only because right now I'm very young. I'd like to finish college. I'd like to have a piece of paper, you know, that all-important piece of paper that says that I'm qualified to do something. And so I didn't want to have to be going through college and relearning how to see on top of relearning, you know, how to read and how to write. Now writing isn't such a big deal with computers and that sort of thing.
And of course, one of the reasons that I met you is because of Dennis.
Yeah.
Dennis Wu, our producer, engineer, morning jazz host, is here with us. And he was the first person that you had an encounter with here at UTEP. And he's mainly responsible for training you as far as being a disc jockey.
Yeah, see, and it's Dennis is a really for anybody who doesn't know Dennis, the one number one thing you should know about him is that he's one of the most altruistic people that you will ever meet in the city, and he is all about giving, you know, everybody a chance at whatever. You know, he's game for almost about anything. And I met him because we were doing a couple of gigs. There was like something that he booked us for over at the Isleta Mission a while back. I must have been 17 or so. You know, then there was some money that came about. There's a summer work program for people that employs people with all disabilities, and it's through the Texas government. And so, you know, my counselor, you know how it is with those types of things. Sometimes counselors don't want to do what counselors are supposed to do. And he simply said, you know, well, why don't you find your own job? And, you know, I was 18 years old at the time, and I said, you know what, I'm going to be really creative, and I'm going to go out on a limb. And I got a hold of Dennis, and he said, you know what, yeah, let's try it out. Let's bring you on board. And so I've had the pleasure to do this. This is my third year doing this.
I'm really happy that you're part of the family here at KTEP. And I have to tell you, when you phoned me, it was over the Memorial Day holiday 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I didn't return your phone call immediately. And the reason why is because I knew I wanted you. I just had to figure out how to make our station what they call ADA friendly. Mm-hmm. And finally, it just got to the point after talking to a number of friends of mine at Alloprint, mm-hmm. Down in Alabama, where they do public radio and readings for the blind and whatnot. And I talked to a number of people down there, and I said, well, what do I need to do? I said, well, you know what? Just hire him, and he'll more than likely have a braille reader or a typewriter, and just have him go ahead and label the board. And that's how you that's what you did.
That's exactly what I did. I'm actually in the process of relabeling it. The labels are getting kind of yucky on there, so I'll redo those. But generally what happens in the world that we live in is you grow up and you go through, especially if you're in the district and especially if you have a family that advocates for you like I did, you get things kind of handed to you. And when you get to college, you figure that people don't necessarily have everything that you need and don't want, you know, aren't necessarily willing to put in the time or the effort to help you. So a lot of time you have to come up with your own solution.
You know, the solution actually had started maybe about a year before that, mm-hmm. when you were with the Youth Jazz Ensemble, when the Jazz El Paso Connection was around. I'd actually met you at a performance over at the McKillican Canyon.
That's right.
And, you know, and it struck me that your knowledge of jazz at that tender age was incredible. And I kept thinking that, you know, you're going to turn this into something really positive. And then when you got into the first jazz camp that the El Paso Friends of Jazz Society put together, you and Christian Chasonic and a number of other folks came to the radio station and did an interview. And I thought, man, if there was just a way that I could hire you and put you on the staff, because your knowledge of jazz is just impeccable.
Well, it's not impeccable. Nobody's knowledge is impeccable. But I do enjoy learning. I enjoy absorbing information. And, you know, a teacher of mine and a friend, a very dear friend, his name is Gary Pratt. He's on the music staff at California State University at Northridge. You know, we had a conversation a long time ago, and he said, you know, man, if you listen to me, if you turn every experience, if you turn the world into a classroom, then life is just so much better, and you see things so much differently. You turn every experience into a learning experience. Everything, if the world becomes your classroom, then that's when you have a really interesting and awesome life. And that's what's so cool about working here, is that I'm constantly being educated. I've shown Dennis some new things. He's shown me plenty of new things. And it's always a learning experience. I get to, you know, interview people that come through, local musicians, things like that. And it's just so great to be a part of that.
And I watch you grow over the years. And one of the things I've noted about you is that you're such a sponge for info. Incredible. And I've learned so much from you about the new genres of jazz. And I really appreciate what you bring to the table.
Well, I really appreciate you having me. And again, like I believe that the more open that you are, the better. I don't want to, you know, if I can learn something new every day, then I'll be happy. If I can learn two things new, then I'm, you know, I'll be ecstatic.
I have a question. What got you interested? What got you started in drums in the first place?
I was always kind of hitting on things, you know, whatever, pans, pots, whatever was available. I used to make music out of everything that was around the house. It didn't matter what it was. I still do it to this day. It drives everybody crazy, but that's okay. My parents got me, I think it was like a little tiny toy drum. I got it from like my third birthday, and I busted the head on that. Then they got me like a tin drum set from like Sam's or Walmart or something. And then after that, you know, I busted the heads on that. And then they got me a slightly higher model from Walmart. And I had that until I was about 12 years old, and that was when I started to get really serious about music. From the time I took a couple of lessons from the time I was like 5 to 6 and a half, and then my teacher couldn't teach me anymore, so I stopped. And so from that time until I was 11 or 12, it was mainly I played things like Motown records, things that I grew up with in my house, R&B stuff, you know, even you know, Snoop Dogg or Dr. Dre. You know, my dad would say, man, this I need you to figure out this beat, and I'd figure it out.
You know, one of the things that I remember most about last year is that you went to New York and came back with this incredible line of stories, these incredible experiences you had, including playing in nightclubs that, heck, half of the people here in El Paso would kill just to be able to go to the nightclub, let alone play.
Well, you know, I was doing really well last year as far as gigs, and I don't have much to worry about. I can still live with my family and things like that. So I saved up and I went. And I was dating a girl at the time who was living on the East Coast. She was living in Washington, D.C., or Alexandria, really. And so it was only a hop, skip, and a jump to get from there to New York. And I have a cousin who's in Brooklyn. And so, you know, when I go, I don't have to worry about things like hotel. And so it's all up to me for, you know, paying my way there and getting, you know, food and getting into shows and things like that.
You spent how long in New York?
I went 3 times. The first time I went, I went to go see a jazz artist. Her name is Gretchen Parlato, and I went to go see a free concert for her. And I literally went, and then I came back on Sunday. My girlfriend had a choral concert. It was a Christmas choral concert that next Sunday. So we left Saturday and came back that next Sunday.
Wow.
And then the second time, we stayed for, I would say, about 5 days. No, 3 to 5 days, I guess.
Okay.
And then this last time that I went, I stayed for a week. And that was when I was able to study with Francisco Mella, who is playing with, like, everybody in the world at this point.
And you got to jam at a couple of the nightclubs, no?
Yes, I did. I went to Smalls. I went to Fat Cat. And those were the two clubs that I actually played at. And those are the two hottest clubs, I would say, right now for young cats. They've got, you know, late night jam sessions till 4 in the morning. You get out. I remember one of the nights we went to Fat Cat and stayed the whole time. And by the time we got back to Brooklyn, it was about 6:30 in the morning. You know, the sun was coming up and that sort of thing. But it's so great to go in there, and you just never know who's going to show up. The last time I went, I ran into Gregory Hutcherson, who is, you know who Gregory Hutcherson is.
He's an incredible vibraphonist.
Vibraphonist and drummer, and mainly drummer. And man, I mean, it was crazy. You know, we had just finished watching a show at Smalls, and then there he comes through the door. Hey guys, how's it going? And he had met with the friends that I was staying with in New York, and it was an incredible experience.
Lawrence, since the last time I saw you, well, the first time I saw you after I had not seen you for a while, you have a dog now. And I recently read a book called Until Tuesday by Luis Montalban. And this is basically a book about a highly decorated captain in the U.S. Army, Luis Montalban, who never backed down from a challenge during his 2 tours of Iraq. And after returning home, however, the pressures of his physical wounds, traumatic brain injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder began to take their toll. And constant physical pain, he soon found himself unable to climb a simple flight of stairs or face a bus ride to the VA hospital. He drank, he argued, he cut himself off from those he loved. And then Luis met Tuesday, a beautiful and sensitive golden retriever. And in this book, it also tells you about how they train these dogs. And you have one of these dogs.
I do. I have. And is his a service dog or is it a guide dog? I'm not sure.
Is it his was a service dog.
A service dog, okay. And just just a quick note, I really a big, huge thank you to those people that go over there and they come back, you know, with all these scars that are deeper than any physical scar. And these dogs are doing wonderful things for them, wonderful, wonderful things. I've heard many, many stories of these men and the dogs that they get. But my dog is a guide dog. There's several different terms, a seeing eye dog, a guide dog. Unfortunately, it's interesting because seeing eye and guide dog are brand names, because there's a school in New Jersey called Seeing Eye, and there's a school in California called Guide Dogs for the Blind. I went to neither of the schools. I went to Guiding Eyes for the Blind in New York. It's in Jefferson Valley. It's Yorktown Heights, just outside of New York City. I would say about an hour outside of New York City. And it's really changed my life. I really, you know, when I decided, I spent, I guess it must have been 2 years kind of deliberating and thinking, am I going to go back to China or what am I going to do? And it got to the point where it was like, all right, either you go back to China or you get a dog. Because at this point, I'm looking to leave El Paso. I'm looking to move out. I'm looking to go on my own, you know, to a different city. And it's either go back to China, get some more sight, and or hope for some more sight, pray for some more sight, or go and get a dog. And the dog seemed the better of the two options to me, simply because of what I said before about, you know, being happy, being a blind. Overall, that girl, Macy Morse, you can look her up. She seemed like she was a very unhappy individual before her sight. And I was raised, you know, to accept what and who I am. Being blind is a part of me. It's a part of who I am. And I honestly, to be frank, I don't feel that I'm ready to make that complete change, if that complete change is happening. So I got the guide dog. It's my first ever, after being a cane user for almost 20 years of my life. You know, it's been such an adjustment, and it's been such a blessing, really.
How do they match the dog with you, Lawrence?
They do a couple of different things. Halo, my dog's name, that's her name, Halo. She was matched with me. What they do is, the first day that you get there, you do not get your dog. You get there the next day. First of all, they do a home interview. And so they flew a field rep down here to do a home interview here and watch me walk with a cane here in El Paso. Then you go out there, and the trainers get a harness, and they hold the harness. And they match your pull, which is, you know, the pull on the harness, your pace, your speed, your height, what it is that you want to do. I told them, you know, they said, well, what do you have a preference for, a boy or a girl? I said, I don't care what you guys give me. I will tell you, I like to travel. I like to, you know, go around. So Halo's a fairly small dog. It's great. She can fit conveniently on buses, subways, airplanes, all of which I love to be on, going somewhere. So, yeah, they match you based on your lifestyle, on your pace, on everything. Even if you have kids or not, you know, if there's small children in the house, they give you a mild-temperamented one, all that stuff.
And it's not unusual, sound like Tom Jones here, the fact that when you are with your dog, you're going to attract attention. And especially if there are children around, sure, and they're going to want to pet the dog. Is that allowed? Is that a no-no?
It varies from person to person. Some people are so strict that their family does not even touch the dog, whether they have a harness on or not. My rule of thumb is, I do not let anybody touch my dog when the harness is on. When the harness is off, she is fair game, you know, up to a point. You know, I won't, you know, if there's a big crowd of people, I would ask them one by one or something like that. But the rule is, harness on, no touching. Harness off, you know, my family will pet her and play with her if the harness is off. But when the harness goes on, they know not to touch or pet or anything like that.
I have to tell you, it's very hard for me to not pet your dog when she's in the control room, because she's such a cutie. Oh. I mean, she has such an expressive face. And I watch her the other night when you were playing over at the network with the new band that you have. So one of the things I noted is how loyal she is to you. She'll sit there and listen to your music. She'll watch you. Mm-hmm. She'll watch every move that you do on that kit, and sometimes she'll get up kind of like startled and then lay back down again. It's incredible. Guys have this really nice symbiotic relationship.
And it's – well, that's the key to a healthy guide dog. They call it a team. You know, each team, you know, that's what they call it when you get to the school. Each team is different. Each team has different needs and has different things. And the goal is that you build that bond. I know for the first 2 weeks, the only time, and I'm not kidding you here, the only time that I spent away from my dog, and that they allow you to be away from your dog for the first 2 weeks about, is, you know, when I got in the shower and when I went to bed. you know, other than that, you go everywhere together.
And how does she react to your other members of your family or to other friends? So how does that happen if you're not around, if you're in the shower or you're somewhere else? How does she react to your family?
She reacts really wonderfully. She's extremely obedient. You know, she does – she'll try things. She'll try. But again, it's like raising a kid or, you know, that sort of thing. If, you know, anybody's had kids, you'll understand what I'm talking about. When you have to set boundaries and you have to – children and dogs, you know, as well as children, they love routine. They think that they don't, and they don't know what's, you know, what's the best for them. But really, in actuality, they love routine. They thrive on it. As a matter of fact, now that I'm coming to the station every day and I, you know, I go and I get up every morning, I do my exercise – and then I get in the shower. Now that she knows that, after I, you know, I get up, I feed her, I groom her every morning. After all that's done, once she hears that bathroom door close, she gets in the crate that's for her. It's in my bedroom. That's where she sleeps. And she waits patiently until I'm ready to go.
Such a little girl in a dog suit.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
One of the things that I'd asked you yesterday, and I want to ask you again today, is you ride the bus a lot. Do you? Is there a different routine with her as your service dog?
On the bus, no.
Yeah.
I mean, she gets on and we sit down. And what they do, all that is taken care of at the guide dog school. You know, they ask you, what is your travel? You know, what are you going to be using? Like, for instance, some people will never use a bus, and that's okay. So they don't make you train to use a bus if you're not going to use a bus. Like for me, I said I want to learn how to use subways because I like to go to New York. I like to go here. I like to go there. I want to use subways. And so they taught me. They said, you know, if you choose not to, you're not allowed to use them. And I mean, obviously, you know, they'll find out. They have their ways of knowing what you're doing and how you're doing and all that sort of thing.
Lastly, I guess, is the question that we would ask anybody. After you get your degree, what's ahead for you?
I would like to work in the commercial music industry. I'd like to work in a studio. I'd like to be an engineer and, you know, hopefully produce things and stuff like that, as well as being a session musician. You know, going in and playing for sessions. I like to be on the road. Music is what I want to do professionally. I know, you know, it's hard. It's one of the lowest paying career choices you could ever choose. But it is a work of heart, and I truly feel that I've been called to do this.
I believe that too. I've seen you behind the traps. I've watched you at performances, and you play with more fervor than most people that I've ever seen in my life, anywhere in the country. The way that you approach drumming is really refreshing. I think Ricky Malachi would agree 100% that you're a showman behind the traps.
Oh, man, I'm not trying to be a showman. You know, I'm not trying to put on an act or anything like that. There's a drummer, and he's one of my favorite drummers. His name is Kendrick Scott. And he writes on his drumsticks, and I found this really humbling, and he put it so well. He writes on his drumsticks, "Lord, let me be an instrument of your peace." And so, you know, when I heard that, I couldn't have, you know, I'd been hearing it and, you know, in different terms and believing it for years. But I'm just a vessel, you know. I'm letting what is coming from somewhere else come through me. I want to... You know, and he talks about it. He's like, you know, quit thinking about what you're wearing, what cologne you have on, what drums you're playing, what cymbals, what sticks you're using. Forget about it. Forget, you know, everything. Just play. Because everything inhibits you from playing except for just focusing on playing and focusing on tapping into that spiritual side. And that's just how I feel about it.
Well, thank you very much, Lawrence, for being with us. And we are not going to forget that you are a vessel, and we are thankful that you are a vessel. Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, our producer, and our co-host, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.